Secretary of State Marco Rubio joins me in an exclusive interview about U.S. policy in the Middle East, religious freedom abroad, and a new breaking peace deal. Foglio will declare St. John Henry Newman a doctor of the church. The National Catholic Register's senior Vatican correspondent Ed Penton will tell us why it matters and will take you to Newman's home. The Archdiocese of Miami gained permission to celebrate Mass at Alligator Alcatraz, and a bishop in New Mexico reinstates a controversial priest, the Papal Posse. Father Gerald Murray and Robert Royal join me with analysis. The World Over begins right now.
Now, Raymond DeRoy.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you tonight. If you'd like to drop a comment, send one to me on X. I'm at Raymond Arroyo and at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. Now to my first guest. He's a former U.S. Senator from Florida, a former presidential candidate, and the 72nd U.S. Secretary of State. I sat down exclusively with Secretary Marco Rubio to talk about the first 200 days of the administration, how he manages to run four separate offices, and he announces for the first time an historic peace deal with Armenia and Azerbaijan. This is your 200th day, by the way, of the administration, which we'll talk about.
But my first interview on this mezzanine, I've never done it before.
You've never done it here?
No. I've seen people do media reports for years from here with a background, and now I get to do one myself.
You've never done an interview here?
Not in this
place.
Wow.
I love that. Cool. Well, it's the perfect backdrop and fitting for a day of celebration. Mr. Secretary, you are the Secretary of State, the Acting Secretary of USAID, the Acting Secretary of the Archives, and you're the National Security Advisor. My first question is, A, how do you balance all that? And secondly, have you seen your wife in person in 6 months?
I have. I saw her in person today.
Did you see that?
Not bad at all, yeah. Well, USAID is largely folded now. The foreign aid part of it is under the State Department now. So it assumes that responsibility. That really is where it always should have been. The National Security Advisor and the Secretary of State roles are very intertwined. In many cases, it's the same issue. Of course, it's always funny to read a memo from the Secretary of State to the National Security Advisor, and so we'll consider him informed.
You know, you have an insight into him
exactly.
Deep personal way.
And then on the archives, you know, of the ones, it probably takes the least amount of time. But the good news is we haven't lost any historic documents. So they're all in place.
This is always
they're
a good thing. Well, here, the other piece of this is, describe to people very briefly, the National Security Advisor, in times past, that individual and the Secretary of State often were at loggerheads, and it became a drag at times on the policy being advanced.
Sure.
Was that part of the thinking here? Let's consolidate this.
I'm not sure that was the thinking, per se. The President had made a decision about making a change, and he wanted the National Security Council restructured and tasked me to do it, and that's what we've done. And so, the way to think about it is our agencies, our cabinet, Senate confirmed cabinet members and Treasury at the Department of Defense, at State, etc. That's our orchestra. And the job of the National Security Advisor is to be the conductor of the orchestra, to make sure that everyone, you know, the president picks the music, the instruments play off the same sheet, and it's the job of the conductor to make sure everyone's playing, that every instrument's playing correctly and playing together. So it's sort of a coordinating role.
Big news this week. Steve Witkoff, your ambassador, goes special envoy, met with Vladimir Putin. There's now going to be a meeting between the president and Vladimir Putin. What do you expect from that meeting? What are you hearing? And what's been your contact with Zelensky?
Well, so hopefully there's a meeting. And I think the president's willing to have one. I think Putin indicated a willingness to have one. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the meeting has to be about something. We're going to have to make some progress here before a meeting like that would be fruitful and worth doing. And so
Did
for
Putin
the first
offer anything to Witkoff?
Well, let me just say that. Obviously, I'm not going to get into the details of everything that was discussed there. But for the first time in this process, there's at least some understanding of what the Russians would need in order to settle, to stop this war from a diplomatic standpoint. Now, I'm not claiming that what the Russians would need and what Ukraine would need are the same.
Right.
There's a difference and there's a gap there. And the question for us now is, can, and we'll be working on that even today, like as soon as I leave here, can we bridge the gap between the Ukrainian side and the Russian side on this close enough so the president can come in as part of any sort of meeting and maybe be the closer on this deal?
Has anybody, I mean, did they talk about a ceasefire? Is that in the
well,
war?
I don't think they're specific about, obviously the goal here is to end the war completely. Yeah. Now, you could talk about the notion that it's very difficult to negotiate details of a peace if you're still shooting at each other. We've always found, like, for example, very recently now with Thailand and Cambodia, the talks in Malaysia were about a ceasefire so they could then negotiate sort of a more permanent deal. But as long as you're shooting at each other, it's hard to negotiate peace permanently.
So that's going to have to be a precursor to
it. We've always felt it is. Yeah. Like, look, if we can arrive at a final deal and it's over completely, that would be great. We'd prefer that, a permanent ceasefire.
Yeah.
But sometimes you need an interim ceasefire simply to get everybody to the table and to talk. Mm-hmm. Because I've seen in the past, you have talks going on, something blows up somewhere, and people just walk away from the table.
Well, let's hope that doesn't happen this time. The president of Switzerland was here yesterday. She flies in, emergency meeting, to meet with you, trying to head off these 39% tariffs that are coming her way. It looks like she didn't get a reprieve from those.
Well, I certainly don't do the trade negotiations, although I've been in many of them, but I'm not the person in charge of that. That's our team of Howard Lutnick and Jameson Greer and Scott Bessent that have been doing that, and ultimately the president.
Yeah.
So they came in to make a counteroffer or a new offer to our trade negotiators. And as part of that, they're in town. We definitely want to talk about they're a good ally. They're a good partner of the United States from a bilateral diplomatic and geopolitical standpoint. But obviously the issue of trade came up, and I encourage them to make the best offer possible. In the end, every successful trade deal so far has been the president coming in to close it. So you can get a deal close enough, but then you got to sit in front of him, whether it's their president, their prime minister, or their chief trade negotiator, and close it out with the president.
There was something you did early on in February, I think. Your State Department designated six cartels in Latin America as terrorist organizations. How did that change the way the interaction between these cartels and the United States, and who made that decision?
Well, the president makes a decision on our recommendation. Here's the thing. We cannot continue to just treat these guys as local street gangs. Mm-hmm. They have weaponry that looks like what terrorists, in some cases armies, have. They control territory in many cases. Those cartels extend from the Maduro regime in Venezuela, which is not a legitimate government. We don't recognize the Maduro regime as legitimate. It is a criminal enterprise, all the way to the various different cartels that operate in Mexico. And in between, you find them in Ecuador, you find them in Guatemala, you find TDA, what people would call street gangs, but actually operating as criminal enterprises, but very well-organized ones. So what it changes is it gives us legal authorities to target them in ways you can't do if they're just a bunch of criminals. It's no longer a law enforcement issue. Mm-hmm. It becomes a national security issue.
Has it changed their behavior at all?
Well, I don't know if it's changed their behavior yet, but their behavior is going to have to change one way or another. But it allows us to now target what they're operating and to use other elements of American power, intelligence agencies, the Department of Defense, whatever, to target these groups if we have an opportunity to do it. We have to start treating them as armed terrorist organizations, not simply drug dealing organizations. Right. Drug dealing is the kind of terrorism they're doing, and it's not the only.
Yeah.
You know, they also are into human trafficking, they smuggle anything, and there's been nascent cooperation between them and some international terrorist organizations in the past, which pose an ongoing danger to the United States.
Let's talk for a moment about the Israeli-Gaza Hamas conflict. It looks like Benjamin Netanyahu wants to occupy Gaza. And Hamas is saying there'll be no ceasefire. We need a ceasefire. And we're not giving you these hostages until our terms are met. Where is the United States on this? Is occupation of Gaza the right way to go right now? And what about the humanitarian
crisis? Let me say, ultimately, what Israel needs to do for Israel's security will be determined by Israel. I can tell you the way to break this out is there are three problems there at the same time. Number one is the one that's getting almost all the media coverage, and this is the humanitarian problems that we're seeing there. And there, you know, no one wants to see that. And the United States stands prepared to contribute towards any real effort that will actually get food and medicine and life-sustaining aid to people on the ground in Gaza. That's number one. The second is that there are 20 innocent people being held hostage and starved inside of tunnels. Unfortunately, there aren't daily cameras down there covering that, and so you don't see the mainstream beat media covering it. But there are 20 people that have done nothing wrong that are being held as hostage, and we saw the conditions that they're living in the other day. And the third is that as long as Hamas exists, particularly exists as an armed organization, there will never be peace in Gaza. because that Hamas is not going to suddenly change and go into another line of work. Their line of work, their reason for existing, is they want to destroy Israel. They want to drive every Jew out of the Middle East. That's their goal. And as long as a group like that has weapons and the ability to fight, they're a threat to peace. So we have to deal with all three of those elements, not just the humanitarian. Mm-hmm. That's important. But the other two have to be dealt with as well. Not enough attention is being paid to those two. And it's not easy because Hamas thinks they're winning the global PR war. They're not willing to make any concessions.
Well, clearly, they're winning something. Your allies, Canada, France, right. the U.K., are prepared to recognize the Palestinian state there.
Well, if you notice, the talks with Hamas fell apart on the day Macron made the unilateral decision that he's going to recognize a Palestinian state. And then you have other people come forward, other countries say, well, if there's not a ceasefire by September, mm-hmm. we're going to recognize a Palestinian state. Well, if I'm Hamas, I basically conclude, let's not do a ceasefire.
Right.
Because we can be rewarded and we can claim it as a victory. So those messages, while largely symbolic in their minds, actually have made it harder to get peace and harder to achieve a deal with Hamas. They feel emboldened.
Well, and the Arab League isn't in favor of this. I mean, clearly, the Arab League says you got to get Hamas out of there. They need to drop arms and move on. But do you agree with Netanyahu that this would be a reward for Hamas?
Statehood?
By giving them statehood?
A recognition, absolutely. Look, statehood is it's not a real, what these people are talking about isn't real. They can't define the borders or who's going to run it. I mean, you can't have a state or even an autonomous region unless you can identify who's going to run it. And if it's going to be run by Hamas, you're going to be right back into war.
Yeah.
So I think what's important to remember here is that, by the way, they've had opportunities to do this. Mm-hmm. You know, Israel turned over Gaza, turned it over completely with greenhouses and all kinds of things. And they elected Hamas. Hamas destroyed it. Destroyed it all, took it, built tunnels instead of hospitals. That's what they do. So here, at the end of the day, my problem with it is that I believe that these unilateral steps that have been taken by these governments, has emboldened Hamas and made it harder to achieve peace. Mm.
Your department recently made headlines. You are instituting a pilot plan where people who are coming to the country to visit, when they file for their visa, they have to leave a bond of $10,000, $5,000 for children. Why are you instituting this? And is this going to help people actually go back to their country?
Yeah,
I know that's what it's
It's not for every country. It's for countries that have high rates of visa overstays.
Uh-huh.
What generally happens is people will get a visa, they come to the U.S., it expires in 6 months, and they don't leave. Now they're here illegally. Uh-huh. Very common. And happened a lot. In fact, I would say at one point, I don't know what the latest numbers are, but more than half the people in this country illegally were visa overstays. Mm-hmm. So for countries that have high rates of visa overstay, you post a bond, and the bond gets collected against. And obviously, obviously now some third party is going to try to verify whether this person is truly going to come back or not. I'm not saying it solves all the problem, but it's an innovative way to sort of cut down on visa overstays.
There's been a huge challenge in the issuance of visas to foreign-born Catholic priests and religious.
Yeah.
I know it's bollocksed up in fraud in unaccompanied minor visas. Now, I don't know how those two became conflated. I think the Biden administration attached them or threw them into the same category. What can be done?
Well, first is to separate the one from the other. And in many cases, what you were finding is you had X number of people you're going to allow a year. You prioritized people that were coming here from a different migration, and it came at the price of some of these others.
I see.
So we're trying to separate the two from it and create its own standalone process. And I've been in touch, for example, with a number of our cardinals here in the United States and bishops about that as well. And it's not only the Catholic Church. I mean, there are other places that are being impacted by it. But we're trying to streamline that process. We clearly view that entry point is very different than some of these others. And but when you basically say there's 100 available, I'm just using that number, and the pot is that big, someone's going to lose out. You know, I mean, you start losing slots, and that includes religious.
Would you be
religious.
In favor of extending those special visas that some of the religious and
potentially? I mean, we're going to look at it. We're looking at every option. Look, we don't want to read headlines that some Catholic church had to close because it couldn't get their priests here, or they couldn't get, you know, some order closed because some nun couldn't get here. So we're not interested in that. And that's really not the aim here. It's more caught up in the structure of it. We'll have a plan to fix it. We're working on it. Okay. We know it's an issue, and we're committed to fixing it.
The Immigration and Nationality Act allows you, as Secretary of State, to revoke student visas if they're engaged in, I'm going to quote, speech that compromises a compelling foreign policy interest, and you can revoke a visa from a student for any reason.
And we have.
And you have, because of anti-Semitism being expressed and other toxic speech that undermines foreign policy objectives of the United States. Now you're being sued by a Stanford newspaper and a free speech activist group. Where do you stand on this now?
They're wrong. They're, I mean, anybody
they say it's a First Amendment violation.
Well, that had nothing to do with what their opinion is. It has to do with what the impact of it has on the United States. Let's remember, again, student visas, okay, are not a right. There is no constitutional right to a student visa. A student visa is something we decide to give you. And by the way, visas of every kind are denied every day all over the world. As I speak to you now, someone's visa application to the U.S. is being denied. So if I would have denied you a visa, had I known something about you, and I find out afterwards that I gave you a visa and I found this out about you, why wouldn't I be able to revoke your visa? If I wouldn't have let you in had I known this, like if this guy, Khalil, whatever his last name is, if that guy had been saying and doing abroad what he's now doing in the United States, we never would have given him a visa. Mm. He was on TV, I think it was yesterday or the day before, arguing that October 7th had to happen, that it had to happen, that it was a necessary evil. Now, he didn't call it an evil.
Yeah.
He said it's a necessary thing, it had to happen. Why is a guy like that allowed into the United States on a visa? He's not entitled to a visa. So it has nothing to do with what they're saying. It has to do with what they're doing and its implications on the U.S. Student visas are a privilege. They are not a right. Mm.
I want to talk about this day. As we sit here, it's the 200th day of the administration. Major and for the most part, unrecognized peace deals that you all have worked out. Yeah. The Cambodia deal, the Congo deal. I want you to talk briefly about those. 49 Christians were killed by Islamic extremists. More Christians are killed in Nigeria than any place on earth. What else can we and should we be doing?
Well, unfortunately, in those places, you have these Islamist, jihadist elements operating inside the country that deliberately target Christian communities and others, but they target Christians, especially in Nigeria, as you pointed out. And so I think what we want to do is work closely with Nigerian authorities to prevent that. They have to make it a priority to prevent it. On the broader issue of peace, the president is committed to peace and committed to being the president of peace. And so we saw when India and Pakistan went to war, we got involved directly, and the president was able to deliver on that peace. Cambodia and Thailand more recently. Azerbaijan and Armenia. Yeah. Hopefully we're taping this here today, but on Friday of this week, we'll be here to sign an agreement and the beginning of a peace deal there. Yeah. DRC, Rwanda, a 30-year war, 7 million people killed. We were able to bring them here to sign it. Obviously, peace is not permanent. It always has to be worked and maintained.
Yeah.
But we're very proud of those initiatives, and we're looking for more. Obviously, the big one being in Ukraine and Russia. We want to see that as well. But we dedicate a significant amount of time to stopping and ending wars.
And what's the difference between what you all are doing, what you're doing at this State Department and the president's leadership, as opposed to these conflicts that dragged on during the last administration?
I think the biggest is the president's direct involvement in them. One thing is, you know, we get involved, we help with the technical aspects of it, the mechanics, and we do a lot. I mean, it's a team effort. The vice president's been involved in some, Steve Witkoff, obviously. It's another when the president is calling directly and saying in some cases to countries, you know, we have this trade thing we're working on with you, but we can't do it if you guys are going to be fighting a war with each other. So that personal engagement by the president that I've witnessed, particularly just very recently with Cambodia and Thailand, that I think made all the difference in the world, certainly expedited. Understand that from the time he made the first call to the time they stopped firing at each other, it was about 36 hours. You know, usually these things take 6 weeks, not with President Trump.
Hmm. Give me a sense. You were there in the room when he was launching those attacks on Iran. You were there, I imagine. Describe to me how the president walks through these moment-by-moment decisions when the national security and the national prestige is on the line.
Well, I think you make a determination that we have a target identified. The first thing to understand about that operation, it was very defined,
targeted.
In essence.
Yeah.
It was targeted. It wasn't about starting a broader war. It was actually an effort to escalate in order to de-escalate. It had a very clear objective.
Mm-hmm.
He established the objective. His military planners offered him a timeline, and then there were checkpoints along that timeline where we had to go back and check with the president. Are you okay? Are you okay? You know, all of those thresholds were crossed. It happened very calmly. You know, now, you know, he was president before, so he's been through this in the past. But it was executed on, and then we were done. He wasn't tempted to say, let's go back and do it again, or let's do more, let's find some other place.
Yeah.
He had a very clear objective in mind, and he achieved it, and we immediately pivoted now to our goal was, okay, we achieved this objective. Mm. Now how do we end this war on the 12th day and not let it become a regional war after 21?
Yeah. You were in Rome during the Pope's installation, the new Pope, Pope Leo's installation. Give me a sense of how, now as Secretary of State, has the relationship at all changed or shifted from Pope Francis's reign to that of Pope Leo's?
Well,
what did you see in person from the man himself?
Well, it was you know, when I interact with leaders of the Catholic Church, they're almost invariably from some other country, yeah. especially at that level. So it was almost surreal to sort of interact with an American, you know, that's sitting across the table, because you're not used to that when it comes right. to at that level, obviously.
And they get the nuance in the speech and the things.
Yeah, and they understand, you know, our history, our politics, mm-hmm. our culture, what's going on here, yeah. things of this nature. They know, you know, many cases maybe they don't know too much about you when it's an American. I think they know a lot more about you because they follow it no matter
right.
what. So all that was very unique, obviously. But I would say that right now, the you know, it's been new, and the papacy, it's, you know, only been there for yeah. less than 100
yeah.
days.
Yeah.
So I think that's still establishing itself, and he'll have to make decisions about. So right now, I think it's good. I mean, we have good communication. Mm-hmm. We've talked to the church, for example, extensively about Gaza. When a church was attacked there, we were mm-hmm. able to facilitate visits there. There's a cardinal now that's in Gaza at that church permanently. I mean, kind of not, I wouldn't say trapped, but he's certainly yeah. there. We've been in communication with them on that. So it's a good relationship, but it's new. It's a new papacy. It's a new direction.
Yeah.
And I think, again, I'm speculating because I'm not in the conclave, but I think one of the things that the cardinals probably chose is someone that sort of could provide a period of stability and consistency as the church faces a myriad of challenges around the world and can both reach out to areas where the church is growing, but also sort of reinvigorate the church in some places where perhaps it's struggling.
I remember in 2019, you gave a speech at CUA, just mm-hmm. up the street here, Catholic University of America, and it was on the last Pope Leo.
Yeah.
And
common good capitalism.
Common good capitalism. Yeah. This seems to really resonate with this new pope.
I think so. We didn't get into depth on it, obviously, but... Yeah. But
did you talk about it at all?
Well, I mentioned it, and I made sure they had a copy of it, because the speech was back in 2019.
Yeah.
But I do think that Catholic social doctrine, which is highly intellectual, mm-hmm. Has a lot to offer, even non-Catholics, in terms mm-hmm. of forming... At the core of it, right, is the belief that is the market the tool or the purpose? I don't think the market is the purpose. I think the market is a tool. Mm-hmm. The purpose is providing people meaningful work, an economy that grows, but grows by creating jobs. You know, we have an expectation that people work, but we also should have an expectation that the economy is creating good work. Mm-hmm. And from work flows everything. We're made to work. And from work flows everything, stability in families, stability in communities. So I think the simplest way to describe it is we believe in capitalism, a capitalism that generates economic growth, an economic growth that creates wealth, but doesn't only create wealth. Mm. It also creates opportunity. It also creates jobs. It also benefits the common good.
No. Well, you have a unique... there are articles. I'm not the first to say this, but I thought... When you became Secretary of State, you have a unique opportunity to interface with the Vatican on a level that, frankly, other secretaries have not had in the past because of that experience.
I think the Vatican can play a very key role in many parts of the world. They're actually very skilled diplomatically. In the end, their number one goal has to be, you know, I wouldn't call it the national interest of the Vatican, but the church and its presence in different places. I know they're deeply concerned, for example, that the church is being heavily persecuted in Nicaragua, as an example. So they're always concerned about the church in China, which has been a point of friction with the U.S. government in the past. But, they're important, and they've offered to get involved in any way they can on bringing about peace as a forum or as a facilitator.
Yeah.
So these are things maybe we'll be able to work on.
Yeah. Very quickly, couple of cultural things. Howard Stern looks like he's losing his show. Stephen Colbert has lost his show. What's happening culturally, and how is this president a part of it?
I don't know if it's just culturally. I think ultimately these are businesses, and the landscape, the media landscape, the way people are getting news, information, and entertainment is rapidly changing across the board. Yeah. It's rapidly changing. And so I think we are living in an era in which sort of what we describe or consider traditional media is going to erode in favor of some, I think everyone's trying to reinvent themselves. We saw newspapers go through this. We saw other media formats go through this. Yeah. And I think it's now finally reaching broadcasters. Yeah. And I think that both on radio and television, it's just a rapidly changing landscape. The overwhelming, increasingly, majority of people are not getting their news sitting live in front of a program.
Yeah.
They're getting a clip on social media, or they're getting it from an alternative site that's providing news and information. The good news is we have more providers than ever of news and information and entertainment.
Yeah.
The bad news is we have more sources, you know, and they're all over the place. So I think as much as anything else, the bottom line is that Colbert and Stern, I don't know the details of it, are being fired because their audiences don't like what they're offering, and they don't have a long-term future.
Mm. Final question. You saw Cynthia Erivo, the wicked actress, played Jesus in Jesus Christ Superstar at the Hollywood Bowl just this past weekend. You are an ex officio member of the Kennedy Center. My question is, would you ever put that show with Cynthia Erivo at the Kennedy Center?
I didn't know it. I'm so busy. I don't follow any of this stuff. But just how you've described it to me, no. I mean, obviously, look, that stuff's done to be provocative and to insinuate. But I think for people of faith, none of this should be new.
Yeah.
It's been true from the beginning of Christianity. Christianity's been mocked. Christianity's been attacked from its very inception. Mm-hmm. In fact, the church has traditionally been at its strongest when it's the persecuted church.
Yes, it is.
It's been at its weakest when it sort of gets consumed by the culture. So by definition, Christianity has always been countercultural.
Yeah.
It was from its earliest days, and it's been at its strongest and most vibrant. Yeah. Now, that doesn't mean we seek persecution or we don't take it on. It does, but I think we should understand that in Christ's own command, in Christ's own words, he tells us they're going to hate you because of me. They hated me before they hate you.
Yeah. What will you do when you leave this interview? What does the rest of your day look like?
I'm going over to the White House. We have meetings with the president this morning. We have a visitor from overseas coming into the White House as well to meet with me, not with the president. We have to get ready for the peace signing tomorrow. I'm sure they have other surprises awaiting. I actually have to finish here first. I got to go through some documents here, then run over there, and then I think I may have to come back this afternoon again. So.
Well, I hope you see your family very soon.
I'll see them, yeah.
Thank you so much.
My thanks to Secretary Rubio and everyone at the U.S. State Department for helping to facilitate that interview. That team is incredible. Thank you all. And this week on the Arroyo Grande Show, I sat down with the Wall Street Journal's children's book critic, Megan Cox Gurdon, to discuss the plummeting reading scores in American schools and how reading aloud could be the antidote to this cultural crisis. Take a look. You had five children, have five children. You read to all of them from really before they were born.
Yeah.
Tell me about that and why. What the power of reading aloud as opposed to just reading the written word itself.
Yeah. So reading aloud, one of the things that's wonderful about it, as I mentioned earlier, is that the person who's doing the reading is essentially, you know, applying the training. And it's very easy for and the language that we get through books is more sophisticated than the regular language that we get. So when to use the simplest example, a parent is reading aloud to a child. The parent can read books that are more sophisticated or pitched at a level above the child's age, say. Not to make it demanding and difficult, but it's a child can take in information that's quite sophisticated. You and I may have talked about this before, but you know, we all of us have a receptive vocabulary. So when you read aloud, not only are you giving a child, in this case, again, parent and child, a story, and you're giving them rich language, you're creating worlds in their heads, what the old radio people used to call theater of the mind. It isn't just an intellectual exercise, it's an emotional exercise. I mean, the dimensions of this are extraordinary. And as you know, as I know, you know, when you sit with a child and read, something happens, something more than regular life is happening. But you're also in a process of sort of mutual discovery and excitement when you read a story.
The full Arroyo Grande interview with Megan Cox Gurdon and some cultural commentary you'll want to hear is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show or wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, iHeart. And be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an Arroyo Grande Show episode. This Friday's Prayerful Posse will feature an exclusive with Cardinal Raymond Burke on the power and importance of the traditional Latin Mass. You don't want to miss that. Visit RaymondArroyo.com for all the links. And Pope Leo celebrated Mass for over 1 million young people at the Jubilee for Youth in Rome, while the Archdiocese of Miami has been allowed to offer Masses at a controversial ICE detention facility in Florida. Here with Insight, Analysis is the Papal Posse. Editor-in-Chief of thecatholicthing.org, Robert Royal, and canon lawyer and priest of the Archdiocese of New York, Father Gerald Murray. Gentlemen, thank you both for being here. I want to start with Pope Leo's now historic Jubilee for Youth. It was at the Vatican last week. It closed on Sunday with Mass for over 1 million people, and he reached out to young people to encourage them in the face of suffering and evil. And he said, my young brothers and sisters, you're the sign of a different world, that a different world is possible, a world of fraternity and friendship where conflicts are not resolved with weapons, but with dialogue. Father, Bob, your thoughts on this gathering and the crowds that assembled for this new American pope?
Well, I was very happy to see such a large turnout because this is the beginning of the new pontificate, and I'm sure a lot of people were motivated to be to travel to Rome to be with Pope Leo. So I think that's wonderful. And of course, having read some of the accounts of what went on, the priest chaplains that were with them were very impressed because during Eucharistic adoration, there was true silence in among all the young people, and many confessions were heard. Priests had to go sit for a couple extra hours. Mm. So this is a sign that the young people truly are seeking what the church offers, which is salvation in Christ. And the means of salvation primarily include the sacraments, the gospel being preached, and charity being lived. And that's what these young people were doing.
Bob, I loved his message. He said, if you really want to know God, have him accompany you, you have to meditate on his word. You have to read his word and let absorb it, which I thought was interesting and powerful for this group.
Yeah, I mean, just the mere fact that you can assemble a million young people and you're the Catholic Church, which is supposed to be yesterday's news and, you know, doesn't appeal to young people in the current cultural environment. I think that already says something. I was reading, you know, it didn't get tremendous secular coverage, but it did get some. And I was impressed by the way that some of the secular reporters would say that they were shocked because they went there and they expected that kids would be playing guitars and listening to rock music. Mm-hmm. But they actually prayed.
Yeah.
And I don't know how they organized this. This kind of snuck up on me. I don't know if any of you were already aware of it. But, you know, they have this huge space in Tor Vergata, which is one of the universities in Rome. Mm-hmm. And so they had some dormitories, but a lot of the kids were camping out, you know, sharing food with one another. These are the kind of things that we remember with Pope John Paul II. And it may very well be that the kind of gentler manner and frankly, the Americanness of Pope Leo may bring us back some of that kind of global attraction of young people.
Gents, I don't mean to rain on anybody's parade, but I couldn't let this go. In St. Peter's Square on July 29th, there was one of these Jubilee for Youth liturgies, and a cadre of Eucharistic ministers of Holy Communion were part of this Jubilee celebration. And my question is, Father, back in the days of John Paul II and Benedict XVI, extraordinary ministers of the Eucharist were never used because you got so many priests and bishops and cardinals in and around Vatican City. What's the point of having them here?
Well, I was surprised that they were using extraordinary ministers of Holy Communion precisely because if there's a place where you can find priests to give out communion, it's Rome. And if there's an event involving young people and their chaplains, there was plenty of priests to do that. So the organizers made a conscious decision that they were going to do this maybe for their own convenience, but there also could be an agenda because, of course, there are those who say the church is unfair because we can't ordain women in the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. So what do? Well, we have Eucharistic ministers. It's sort of a substitute recognition that women should be involved. That's not the purpose of extraordinary ministers of Holy Communion. They're only meant to be used where priests and deacons are unavailable and where there would be a great lengthening of the time for the distribution of Holy Communion in the absence of some assistance. So this was a big mistake. I remember the days when Rome was issuing documents criticizing or telling priests and dioceses, you can't have the priests drinking coffee in the rectory while Eucharist ministers are giving out communion at Mass. Mm-hmm. And if there was ever a case where there were priests sitting down, it was at this event. So that shouldn't have happened.
Yeah. For a moment, I saw the wide shot first. And given the hair color of that lead minister, I thought maybe McDonald's was the sponsor. But I'm not going to press that. Gentlemen, Swiss Cardinal Kurt Koch spoke out on the liturgy wars this week. He's quoted in the Austrian website, Cath.net, and he said this about the traditional Latin Mass. Pope Benedict XVI has shown a helpful way by believing that something that has been practiced for centuries cannot simply be banned. That convinced me. Pope Francis has chosen a very restrictive path in this regard. It would certainly be desirable to open the now closed door. Cardinal Kurt Koch. Bob, your thoughts on the Cardinals' observation here? And given what we've seen recently in La Crosse, Wisconsin, at the Shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe, you had Cardinal Salvador Corleone, you had Archbishop Corleone, you had Cardinal Raymond Burke celebrating the Latin Mass. Do you think we will see a reversal of the course set by Pope Francis against the traditional liturgy?
Well, that's certainly what Cardinal Koch said, that it's an opportune time to do this. And, you know, he's the head of the Dicastery for the Promotion of Christian Unity. So it's not surprising in a way. He's been doing that for many years. It's not surprising in a way that he's kind of sensitive to the divisions that can be set up in the church unnecessarily, in fact. And the, you know, the fact that the Latin Mass, as we know, was rather banned or at least curtailed under Francis on unfortunate circumstances. I think that it's inevitable that Pope Leo is going to have to deal with this. We've said this on several mm-hmm. times in the past, but I think that the momentum is starting to grow in that direction.
Yeah.
And I always go back to that view of Pope Benedict that we should allow as much variety within the church as is licit, as is yeah. possible within Orthodoxy. And so to just hive off one part of the Mass that was part of the church for hundreds of years, it just makes no sense. And if it's true, as I think it is, that the young people that we're seeing at Tor Vergata and other places are finding enrichment in that Latin Mass, why not do it?
Yeah. Yeah. I want to move on. The Archdiocese of Miami and Archbishop Thomas Wensky celebrated its first Mass recently at the illegal alien detention facility that's become known as Alligator Alcatraz. Wensky said, "I'm pleased that our request to provide for the pastoral care of the detainees has been accommodated. We were able to respond to a request to provide similar service to the staff who reside in the facility." Father, despite the politics of the situation, allowing the Archdiocese to provide that kind of spiritual care to everybody there seems like a good idea.
No, I praise the Trump administration for allowing this. And this is in line with what the U.S. government does with other institutions. We do have prison chaplains. We have hospital chaplains in federal hospitals, such as for the military. Certainly, I was a military chaplain. The government facilitates the free exercise of religion. So this was a very good decision. And I'm glad that Archbishop Wensky went there. Mm-hmm. And yes, spiritual care should be given to those who are being detained so that they can have an opportunity to renew their faith. And the United States government should promote the free exercise of religion at every single opportunity. Yeah. There shouldn't be a curtailment simply because someone is detained or in prison or in a hospital.
Gents, we have a rather disturbing story to report. According to LifeSite News, New Mexico Archbishop John Wester has granted faculties to a priest that had taken an extended leave of absence 28 years ago. 10 of those years were spent in what he called a committed homosexual marriage in California. Father Steve Rosera, seen here, is now a priest in good standing, serving Archbishop Wester in a number of key positions, including the tribunal that judges annulment cases. Father, your reaction to this story?
Now, this is a very disturbing story because for a number of reasons, one of which, of course, which is in, I read the account of this story on LifeSite, this priest is a homosexual propagandist. He's propagandizing for the homosexual movement in the church. So it's an indication that the lifestyle that he lived in complete contradiction to his priestly ministry, and therefore he, you know, left the priesthood in a sense. He was on a leave. He was never laicized, apparently, never sought that. But now he's coming back and he's taking advantage of the pulpit and the diocesan offices that he has in order to promote immorality. This is really bad. And it sends a terrible message to the whole church, which is a priest who leaves a priesthood becomes a public sinner by engaging in a publicly, it was a civil kind of union that he got into. And we've never heard about any public repentance on that part of this priest for what he did. And now he's just operating as if nothing happened. This is really a disaster. I think Bishop Wester should completely review this decision. This priest should be withdrawn from any offices that he holds. And if there is repentance, then he should, you know, the priest should make a statement publicly that he repents of his evil lifestyle and that now he will do a time of penance before possibly returning to the priestly ministry, but certainly not as an exalted official in the diocese.
Yeah. Bob, what did you think when you saw this? I mean, couldn't they have made him the diocesan gardener or something? Why on the marriage tribunal of all places?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of these stories that if it appeared in a novel, you would say it's absolutely improbable. You got to cut that because it, you know, that couldn't possibly be what a Catholic priest and a Catholic bishop would in good standing would do. I have to say I am not. I'm generally sympathetic to people who repent. As Father rightly says, we haven't seen any repentance here, and I think that at the very least, the Archbishop should have some explanation for this. I don't think there is an explanation, a good explanation for why it is that he had to bring that particular priest into those particular offices. I mean, there are obviously are probably many very good priests in the Archdiocese of New Mexico. So this raises a whole bunch of questions, not only about this priest and what it is that he's doing, but about Archbishop Wester himself. I mean, what kind of judgment is it for an archbishop in a prominent diocese like Santa Fe to bring a priest like that and put him into these very sensitive positions in some respects? So we have no explanation. Everything that we do know seems to be a counterindication for what's actually happening. Right. And in a church in which there's so much uncertainty about sexuality, about homosexuality, this doesn't help us one bit.
I want to move on to this story. It's gotten a lot of movement online. I've been watching people argue about it. Catholic influencer Lila Rose posted on X this week, and she cited a case in Tennessee where an inmate on death row had been recently executed, and she mentioned he was crying out in pain, you know, after lethal injection. According to Rose, quote, "No civilized nation needs the death penalty. His death doesn't bring these innocents back to life. Life in prison is enough." Father, this guy heinously killed two children, 6 and 9 years old. The church has taught for centuries the death penalty can be used in justice, though it ought to be rare. Your thoughts on this? And do we worry about the cries of these victims?
Well, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty in the Catholic Church these days because Pope Francis changed the catechism of the Catholic Church and said that the death penalty is inadmissible. Which is not a canonical or theological category. The Pope also said that Pope Francis, that is, that the death penalty is an act of vengeance, it's an offense against human dignity, and he said it should never be used. The problem with that, of course, is he's contradicting the teaching of the Church, which goes right back to the Old Testament, that in some cases the death penalty is a just punishment and it can be administered by the public authority when there is a just reason to do it, and it's been verified through some kind of procedure, a court procedure ordinarily. So, no, the goal of the death penalty, of course, it's not to bring the dead back to life. That's an argument that just distracts. Mm-hmm. The goal is to restore justice in a situation in which someone has grievously offended justice by killing or otherwise harming people and then did so in a way that can be proven. And that's what we have in this case. Yeah. So, no, this is really an excessive sentimentalism, which always focuses on the killer and not on the victims. And certainly Catholic theology and doctrine teaches the death penalty can be administered justly.
Yeah. And Bob, I mean, Innocent III, right up to John Paul II and Benedict, they left the door open on this question. Now, look, they did say it should be used sparingly, if at all, but it was meant to be a punishment for crime, a warning to others, and a spiritual corrective to the offender. Our friend Cardinal Avery Dulles used to say this is a blessing because it gives the guy who's sinned grievously a window in which to make his peace with God and repent, whereas it's been proven if they don't have that time frame, they go on living the life of crime in the prison. Your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think Father is exactly right about this sentimentality, because a lot of people who spend time in court tell you that what happens in court is there's this poor guy who's sitting there. He committed a heinous crime, and it looks like the whole power of the state is against him.
Well, but everybody forgets about what it was that he actually did, and that in some respects it may actually be good, as you were rightly saying, for not only for society, but for him to have to acknowledge the grievousness of what it is that he actually did. You know, I often hear, I mean, just to make the utilitarian argument for a minute, because this sometimes said that this doesn't deter anybody, and then people go out and they try to find statistics that say that the death penalty doesn't deter people from crimes. Well, I have had a friend who used to make the argument that the mafia has its pact of omerta, and if you break your word to the mafia, you get killed. And that's one of the reasons why people very rarely would divulge what the secrets of the mafia were. So there is in the human soul, we know this, there is just a fear of doing something if there's going to be a terrible retribution. Yeah. So I think in a number of ways, no one likes the idea of having to execute somebody else. But like being a policeman who has to stop someone who's about to commit a murder or harm somebody, it shows that our society isn't really willing to defend itself from some terrible people who seem to be more and more active in our society. We see more and more murders. We see more and more disorder in the society. We need agents of order as well as agents of disorder.
Yeah, no, and I've always been persuaded by Cardinal Avery Dulles, who wrote a fantastic piece on this, and he always said you also have to consider the people who now have to care and protect the prison from these individuals who are heinous. And look, I've never understood the idea that this is vengeful. The idea that the state is carrying it out after a trial inevitably makes it not vengeful because the state is executing this person, not the individual, not the family. They don't allow the victim's families to go shoot the guy in the backyard. No, the state does it coldly and clinically and in its own time. That seems to me a proper distance to allowing this to lapse into vengeful, you know, thoughts. But then the security of these poor prison guards and their families and the other inmates, that's a consideration too. Some of these influencers should go volunteer on death row and maybe they'd come around to a different way of thinking. Before I let you go, this is a kind of disturbing story. A New Hampshire abortion clinic has taken American Girl dolls and reaccessorized them with abortion pills, contraception patches, and other family planning accoutrements. Very quickly, Father, I'll get your reaction to this first.
Yeah, this is the gruesome side of the abortion mafia that they're now want to get little girls and get them to become proponents of abortion by playing with abortion pills and the like. I hope they include a little model ambulance so that if the abortion pill causes excessive bleeding in the process of killing the unborn child, that the mother can be brought to the hospital. I mean, this is it's disgusting. And this is precisely the kind of corruption that the abortion industry engages in. American Doll should denounce this and have nothing to do with that abortion clinic. Really sue them because they're bringing the reputation of that company down with them.
Yeah. Bob, your thoughts. Final word.
Yeah, I'm going to quote an authoritative source. Better that a millstone will be hung around their neck and being thrown into the sea. I mean, why take innocent young girls in that direction? You know, we used to think that abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. And now we're thinking that it should be introduced at an even younger and younger age. What a world.
Yeah. Well, gents, we will leave it there. For commentary from Robert Royal and Father Gerald Murray, visit thecatholicthing.org. And don't miss the Prayerful Posse dropping Friday on the Arroyo Grande Show YouTube channel or wherever you get your podcast. Gents, safe travels. Great to see you both. The Vatican announced this week that Pope Leo XIV will proclaim St. John Henry Newman, Cardinal Newman, a doctor of the Church. How significant is this decision? And what do the 19th century teachings of Cardinal Newman bring us in the 21st century? For more, we're joined by senior Vatican correspondent at the National Catholic Register, Edward Penton. Ed, thanks for being here. Newman becomes the 38th doctor of the Universal Church. This will be one of the first acts of Pope Leo's new pontificate. What brought about this decision to elevate Newman now?
Well, he's been seen as for a long time as obviously somebody who really does promote sound orthodox doctrine. And so there's been a chorus of opinion trying to get him to be made a doctor of the church, which of course that means that's a sign that that the person is a good bastion, if you like, of orthodoxy, and that his teaching is good to be known. And so that's really the reason. And it's been petitioned by particularly the Bishops' Conference of England and Wales, but mm-hmm. also in America as well, the bishops in America and other scholars worldwide. So it's a culmination of all of that.
Yeah, and there's a nice connection here between papacies and, you know, between when he was made a saint to now. What's that connection? What do you see there?
Well, yes, of course, his personal holiness was key to this as well. And he has a great record of that, of course, becoming blessed and then canonized in 2019. So all of that is connected with that and also connected, of course, with his teaching, which is seen as very relevant to today. And we can go into that if you like. But there's various elements of his teaching which many feel is very important today, considering that he had to deal with liberalism in his day. But now, of course, it's taken on a whole new meaning. Mm-hmm. But his teaching is still very relevant to that.
How is this being received in England? And what I was talking about before is Leo XIII made him a cardinal. Now Leo XIV is making him a doctor of the church, which is kind of a nice symmetry there. But how is this being received in England?
Very well, yes. I mean, it's as I say, it was kind of expected. It was sort of, as I say, the fruit of this process. But it also comes at a time when there's a certain revival, signs of a revival, of a Catholic revival in the country. And so it all sort of coincides with that. And very many people think that it's going to help galvanize that in some ways. Perhaps it's going to bring focus to England and to the teachings of Newman in bringing about that, on furthering that revival. So it's all very timely in that regard.
Yeah, I traveled to your native homeland in 2010, just prior to Pope Benedict's historic visit to the UK. And while we were there, we visited the Birmingham Oratory where Newman lived. Take a look. Father Richard Duffield. And he took us on a tour of Cardinal Newman's rooms. These rooms have not been touched since he died in 1890. Take a look.
He died in 1890, and it's unchanged since those days. We've dusted a bit.
Well, I hope so.
But otherwise, it's as he knew it. Everything in the same place, the desk, the chairs, all as he knew it. The lamp on his desk, the two lamps on his desk, one of them, and we're no longer sure which, was given to him by the Prime Minister, Mr. Gladstone, because he used to write letters about matters of church and state to Gladstone.
And you thought it was this one?
When I was a novice and did this guided tour almost every day, I always told everybody it was that one, because that's what I was told by one of the elder fathers. But now I've noticed that the novices say it was this one. And we've not found any proof. We'll have to have a look and see.
Okay.
So the room is unchanged, and the books are as he would have known them. In fact, on this shelf, you have the uniform edition of his complete works, so you can get a sense of just how much he wrote.
Mm.
And that doesn't include the 17,777 letters, which were published, of course, after his death.
And you have all of those here?
They're all here. I'll show you in a moment in the archive where they're all kept in big boxes.
Now tell us about his prédio over here, where he prayed.
Over in that corner is his little prédio with his crucifix and his rosaries. We're going to give one of the rosaries, which has a medal of St. Benedict on the end, to the Holy Father as a gift when he comes. And the crucifix is actually going to go and hang in the shrine, because I think it would be good to have the same crucifix that Newman used to be the crucifix of the altar. And so when the pilgrims come, they're praying before the same crucifix that Newman prayed before at his prédio every night. A little bust of St. Philip. A little timer to time his prayer, too, you'll notice, all there above the prayer desk.
Yeah.
And then we'll go around behind, because oratorians only have one room, usually, and they sleep there, too. When Newman was made a cardinal, in those days, a cardinal was supposed to reside in Rome, unless he was a diocesan bishop, which Newman wasn't, of course. Mm-hmm. And Pope Pius IX said, well, so long as you live in the state becoming a cardinal, you can stay in Birmingham, but you must have your own chapel with its own little dome. A cardinal's private chapel must be set up for you. So while Newman was in Rome receiving the cardinal's hat, the fathers gave him a room next door as a bedroom, and built a partition and made a chapel.
So the chapel is on the other side where the bedroom once was?
Yes, the bed was once the other side of this partition. And then they built this wonderful chapel for the cardinal with its baldacchino. That's the state becoming a cardinal. The picture of St. Francis de Sales, because he was an oratorian before he became the Bishop of Geneva. And Newman chose his motto as a cardinal, Cor ad cor loquitur, which came from the works of St. Francis de Sales, from the Treatise on the Love of God. And so Newman had great devotion to him.
Now, what are all of these pictures on the wall here next to the altar?
He kept pictures of his friends by the altar, so all he had to do was turn his head while he was saying Mass and face the pictures of his friends, so he could make a memento of them while he was saying Mass. Some other treasures in here. I've left on the altar this chalice, which Newman always used, and that's the chalice we're offering to the Holy Father to use at the Beatification Mass. And that's wonderful that he's going to use that. And also, you're leaning on the prie-dieu, which was the cardinal's, and the Holy Father is going to kneel at that, we hope, when he comes to pray in the chapel that we saw downstairs.
And the chair
and the
as
chair
well.
With the coat of arms.
No, I loved visiting the oratory there. It was just incredible. But tell me about, and you alluded to this earlier, Newman's teachings, particularly on the development of doctrine. It's really been controversial in recent years with both sides of the ideological spectrum adopting Newman's thought in their own way. Is this going to cause the conception of doctrinal development to be stretched, perhaps in a way he never intended, in this age of synodality?
Well, those experts on Newman don't think so. And they say, I asked one expert, Monsignor Andrew Wadsworth, who's head of the oratory in Washington, D.C., about this. And he said that he wasn't concerned, not if we're true to what John Henry Newman taught. It's going to be okay, he said. I think that we are better able to counter such attempts by reiterating what he has written. And so very many, I think, just say that really to counteract this sort of twisting of his teaching is really just to read his writings, which are very clear and concise, and come to your own decision, because it's very clear, as I say, and there's really little room to twist it.
Yeah.
And if you know, just compare the two, that's really what they're saying.
Edward, we will leave it there. And you can follow Edward Penton's excellent reporting at Edward Penton on X or at ncregister.com. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you, Remy.
That is all the time we have for now, but be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.